Tragically, 9 people were killed and many others injured in a crowd crush incident in Houston last week. The worst crowd crush incident in history killed 10,000 people in Jerusalem. And interesting enough, it was not long after Paul wrote his letter to the Philippians. The worst in the 21st century was in Saudi Arabia, and 2,400 were killed. And people who study these events say that extreme danger occurs at densities of 6 or 7 people per square meter. So if you think about that, put 7 people in there, that's pretty crowded. I mean, I don't like 6 people per acre, but that's pretty crowded. So at that point, people are unable to move as individuals, and shockwaves can travel through the crowd. It's now acting involuntarily like a fluid. So if a single person falls or if people reach down to help, then waves of body will fall into that void. So you can't, in those circumstances, choose to stand firm. You're pushed about by external forces. In Philippians chapter 4, Paul's going to give some instruction on how to stand firm, how to live with proactive control of our lives. And the folks at Philippi were being pushed by governmental, theological, cultural forces, all kind of threats and challenges. But they could, Paul said, nevertheless stand firm as we can. So look at chapter 4, verse 1. Therefore, my brothers, you whom I love and long for, my joy and my crown, that is how you should stand firm in the Lord, dear friends. So that is how, sort of implies that what he just talked about, but the better translations, like in the ESV, say thus or in this manner. So he's about to tell them how to stand firm in the Lord. So what follows is some clear guidance on standing firm. And standing firm, by the way, doesn't mean be a hard head, but rather to not be a helpless victim of external and internal threats and circumstances. So to stand firm is to live like God, the God we trust, is actually real and involved in our lives. So therefore, my brothers, you whom I love and long for, my joy and my crown, is how he starts. And there's a value-shaping power in that first line. And when he says brothers, it's like when I'd walk up to a mixed group and say, hey guys, he's talking to the whole church, male and female alike. So when he says, you whom I love and long for, he's not just being nice. He really means this. This is a personal letter. He longs for them. They are dear to him. He's not just some theological machine kicking out Bible books. He's concerned with these people. He's writing letters to people he cares deeply about, and he wants to see them again. And he addresses them as my joy and my crown. My joy indicates that his heart is wrapped around them. And for Paul, as is in the scripture, heart for the Lord, heart for people are synonymous. And crown indicates that what he most values, what he counts as his key life accomplishments, what he sees as his triumph are these people. Their spiritual thriving, their good, is his crown of accomplishment. And so this is Philippians 2, 3, putting the success of others ahead of himself, impacting his core values. The costly investment of his life and people is his joy and accomplishment. Everyone I've ever known whose life is full and meaningful lives in a way where they are giving their lives away for others, not just hoarding their lives for themselves. This is unalterable. It is in our design. If you want to live with purpose and joy, live for the good of others. Make their success your accomplishment. Let's move on to how he talks about standing firm. Verse 2, I plead with Euodia and I plead with Syntyche to agree with each other in the Lord. Yes, and I ask you, loyal yoke fellow, help these women who have contended at my side in the cause of the gospel, along with Clement and the rest of my fellow workers whose names are in the book of life. Okay, well, how is it helpful as a point of strategy to get some random comments about some women with strange names in the first century? How does that help us stand firm? Well, we want to pay attention to a couple of clues. This is a very personal and practical remark, but it's not remotely random. None of this is random. So whenever you see something, you say, why is it there? That's the right question to ask. Paul's not random. God's not random in his word. Why the author include this here? And then when he pleads with these ladies to agree with each other, it's more literally that he wants them to be of the same mind. It doesn't mean they have to think the same thing about everything. Good luck with that. I don't know anybody who thinks exactly the same about me, family, friends. That's not his point. So how's the concept of same mind already been used in this letter? That's a clue to understanding this. Go back to chapter 2. He said, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. He said, be make my joy complete by being of the same mind. In verse 5, chapter 2, have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus. So he's making practical application of chapter 2, the mind of Christ, to a current situation which everybody in the church would have known about, these two bickering ladies. They weren't getting along, and the solution is to get the mind of Christ into their minds. They needed to operate in relationship to one another with the mind of Christ, which means don't fight to win your own way. Put each other's interests first. You don't have to think the same way about everything to grow close and get along. You do need to have your mind in line with the mind of Christ. On Friday, two long-term friends, decade-long friends, were at my house for dinner. And they had come to a conclusion, different conclusions about some important things. And the friendship had become strained and had not been together. Friday night, they were in my home. We were enjoying a meal. Still don't see eye to eye on some of those things, but they didn't come up. And I was sitting there at dinner. It's just a dinner. But I was moved because I was watching the gospel at my table. I watched two old friends back together. And they were back together because they were operating out of the mind of Christ. It was a beautiful thing. So have this mind among yourselves, Philippians 2, verse 5, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality of God something to be held on to, but he emptied himself, took the form of a servant. So think your thoughts, have your opinions, have your passions, but approach one another with the mind of Christ, which is a kind of thinking that took him all the way to the cross. It's a mind full of humility and sacrifice. And so the first clue to standing firm we have is stand together by having the mind of Christ. You will not, I will not stand firm for long all by myself. And we'll not stand together for long without the mind of Christ. Our differences will divide us. So let's build our strategy for standing firm starting here. Stand together by having the mind of Christ. Put each other first. And then verse 4, rejoice in the Lord always. I'll say it again, rejoice. This is our second strategic input, but we talked about this at length last week. So if you missed last week, it'd be helpful to go back and listen to it. So our strategic input so far, stand together by having the mind of Christ, rejoice in the Lord, continually approach threats by continually rejoicing your mind in the Lord. And then verse 5, let your gentleness be evident to all, the Lord is near. And gentleness is okay as a translation, but doesn't capture the idea very well. One translation calls it reasonableness, which is kind of a clumsy word. It's hard to capture this word with a single word. So let's try to get to the bottom of what he means by let your gentleness be evident to all, the Lord is near, by way of some common thinking fallacies. One common thinking fallacy that's very popular right now is called labeling, sometimes called ad hominem attack. It means you go after a person versus you go after an idea or an action. So instead of he made a mistake or he disagrees, it's you're an idiot or you're evil. Another thinking fallacy is called straw man, where instead of fairly presenting an opposing side's position, you unfairly present it. You incomplete in your presentation to make your own view look stronger. And then emotional reasoning. I feel this way, so it must be true. I'm right. There are a ton more, but if you look at the common thinking fallacies, the destructive thinking fallacies that cause us a lot of problems, they're addressed in this phrase, let your reasonableness be known to all. This is about clear thinking, truth-guided thinking, rather than emotional reasoning. So be a person who's confident enough in God and what God has revealed that you can deal with the facts of reality as they are. Be passionate about God, be passionate about people, but not about being right, not about misusing facts and words, trying to win the truth, win the day. So it's a passion for truth minus all the smoke and smell of unreasonable emotions. And you can see every single day, hear every single day, stories of people who are ruining their lives, ruining relationships, even falling away from the faith because they refuse to do this, what he talks about, gentleness. And what it means is they're dominated by emotional reasoning versus truth reasoning. They're reactive, not active. So what we have so far is stand together, have the mind of Christ, rejoice your mind in the Lord, and then be a reasonable person, meaning reason from the truth, approach life from the truth, not current emotions. Then look at verse 6. Don't be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. So we have a don't and a do. And the don't is don't be anxious about anything. And if you think about it, that doesn't sound that helpful. If you say, well, Terry, I'm really anxious, what should I do? Well, stop. Stop it. That doesn't sound super helpful, but that's not how he directs us. There's a command, don't be anxious, because there's a corresponding another command, do this. Well, do what? By prayer. Prayer indicates the general conversation with God. God, I'm worried. God, I'm sad. God, I don't know what's going on. Petitions, it's what that word means. Help me, please. And then thanksgiving, remembering God's goodness and mercy so we don't become ungrateful, consumed with our own immediate problems, forgetful of what God has done. And so in this attitude of honest talking, passionate asking, deep gratitude, take your request to God. And Paul said, when we live in this kind of conversational, concern-sharing, thankful relationship with God, then, so there's the don't, the do, and the then the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ. So this peace could mean, and probably does to some degree, that we'll have this increased, unexplainable sense of well-being, or at least an improved perspective on the things that concern us. And it can transcend our understanding because it flies in the face of current circumstances around us. And many Christians through the centuries have experienced this peace in the face of terrible suffering and even imminent death. But there's another aspect of this verse that makes it much more objective than just subjective. Because what if we don't feel peace? What if we don't have a sense of well-being? Maybe because we haven't eaten well or slept well. Maybe there's chemical imbalances in our body. What if we're sick? What if something terrible happened? Have you had times when you had no sense of well-being, that emotional sense of well-being? And so what does this verse say to us during those times? Where is this peace that we tend to define as a subjective sense of well-being that we're promised when we are praying and we are trusting God, but yet it's not there? We need to look at this a different way than just the surface value. Guard, and he said, let the peace of God will guard your hearts and minds. It's a military word. It's a peace that guards us is a sentry on our hearts and minds. So remember, Philippi was a Roman military garrison, and there were guard sentries everywhere, guarding Roman interests, keeping insurrection at bay. So people who thought they were going to be disruptive to the peace, they're thinking about something, and there's guards standing everywhere. And they were guarding the peace. That's what they would have thought about when they heard this. So it's not just that we feel God's peace, this emotional sense of well-being. Now, we want that. When I don't have a sense of well-being emotionally, I want it. But this is much more than that. It's God's objective peace, the reality of peace with God for the believer that acts as a sentry, a guard over our hearts and minds. So if you know me for a while, you've heard this story before, but it's very illustrative of this principle. Hopefully it'll translate to your experience in principle at least. So when I was in Iraq in 2009, I had a multi-month period of time where I felt near continual anxiety on the inside, lost weight, had little appetite. At the same time, I knew that God had brought me there. I knew that God was at work in and around me. And most importantly, I knew that I belonged to Him, that He'd saved me. I was, in fact, at peace with God. He was not going to abandon me. So I often had the absence of a sense of emotional well-being, that subjective feeling. But the objective fact of my peace with God through Jesus Christ acted like a sentry over my heart, my will, my mind, my thoughts. And that sentry, that settled reality of relationship with God, was like the gate guard for my mind and emotions. The peace I had was not, I'm feeling at peace, I'm feeling groovy, whatever. It was the sentry that held those things in count. The peace of God was the objective fact that I have a relationship with God through Jesus Christ. I had thoughts that were not always true. The sentry of peace with God checked those thoughts. I felt some things that weren't aligned with what is real. The sentry of God's peace checked them, called them to account. And this is similar to that passage where Paul wrote that we're to take thoughts captive to Christ. Thoughts show up, and we just go, it's this thought, it's a thought. No, we're supposed to, you know, if that thought doesn't submit to Christ, you've got to go. And so when I had thoughts of despair and discouragement, the reality of peace with God, the fact of my peace with God, was a sentry that said, halt, who goes there? Enormously helpful. As it turned out, it was the most miserable and the most powerful time of my life. I rarely felt this emotional sense of God's presence, but I had never seen God at work like that before or since. This is a peace that passed understanding, not merely feelings of peace. I mean, people can have feelings of peace if they smoke enough dope. That's not what this is. This is about living in the actual, factual peace of God in spite of, often, lack of feelings of well-being. So read the Psalms with this template in mind. The psalmist would often despair of what they felt and proclaim what was in fact real. And when I've talked to people in desperate situations, people have just lost loved ones, I've often said, feel what you feel, but resolutely believe what is real. And you may feel like God's abandoned you. You must proclaim the truth of God. My God has not, my God will not forsake me. So let's update our stand firm strategy with this point. Stand together, have the mind of Christ, rejoice your mind in the Lord continually. Be a reasonable person, ruled by truth, not by passions. And then pray and live resolutely in the reality of your peace with God. Let's go to verse 8. Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about these things. So this is our final strategic stand firm input. It sounds like a lot of inputs there, but really it's one, just expressed different ways. You could summarize it like this. Choose carefully what you let happen in your mind because you can. You must, but you can. And many people grew up in churches being told exactly what to watch or what to listen to, what movies and music were okay and what were not. Made life simple, like here's the list, or don't watch movies with this letter attached to it, or whatever. Don't watch these, don't listen to this music. But it wasn't always helpful in shaping people in the image of Christ. And this idea of watching what you watch and what you listen to is important in principle, because what we watch, what we listen to, what we let rattle around in our heads shapes our lives. The problem was the approach has often been historically very much an outside in, or a sort of don't be shaped by that rather than an inside out, and a do be shaped by this approach. So you could avoid certain movies and songs and still remain very far from Christ, because there's a purpose for what the believer does and doesn't do. The purpose is, I want to be shaped in the image of Christ. The Taliban has strong rules about movies and music, but I'm telling you, all their don'ts is not making them more like Jesus. The right approach to thinking about our thinking is, who do I want to become? What do I want to be true about my life? So then, should I watch that? Should I listen to that? Should I read this? Should I continue thinking about that? Then, how do I want to be shaped? How's that shaping me? Paul said to the church at Corinth, all things are lawful, but not all things are helpful or beneficial. So who do you want to be? And then ask with that larger, more powerful, more important question in mind, is this going to help me become that? Decide who you want to be, then decide in ongoing fashion, what are the thoughts, what are the influences I'm going to allow to shape me? And it impacts your life, what we allow in. What we watch, what we listen to, it matters. Not because we're trying to prove something to somebody, but because we have a goal in mind. We want to become like Christ, and we want to choose what shapes us. So we have five strategic inputs for standing firm. I won't read them again. I've read them several times. I'll read them one more time in a minute. And then, again, Paul's going to encourage them to use him sort of like a rifle scope to align on the larger target. He said in verse 9, whatever you've learned or received or heard from me or seen in me, put it into practice and the God of peace will be with you. And so a rifle scope lets you focus on a far-off target by having something closer to your eye to focus your eye in the distance. So Paul isn't saying he's a target, Christ is a target. He's saying, I'll be this scope to help you get a fix on Christ. And so then we're going to finish with some really well-known verses, but let me set them up with some less well-known verses. Verse 10, I rejoice greatly in the Lord that at last you've renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you have been concerned, but have had no opportunity to show it. So again, this is a personal letter that God has blessed us that we get to have and read and learn from. The church in Philippi sent some gifts to Paul for use in his ministry to share with other churches that were suffering, and he was grateful for it for many reasons, not the least of which it was good for them to give. And from this practical sort of normal event, the normal event was the giving of an offering, he's going to give a principled application of what it means to stand firm, what it looks like in actual practice. So he says, thanks for the gift, but I'm not saying this because I'm in need. And here's a more famous passage. I've learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I've learned what it is to be in need. I know what it is to have plenty. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or want. I can do everything through him who gives me strength. So thanks for the gift. Awesome. But don't hear me saying I was in need, because I wasn't. Because I've learned to be content whatever the circumstances. This is not ingratitude. This is him using a practical situation to cast a bigger vision for what it means to stand firm. Whether living in need or in plenty is an abbreviated definition of the entire gamut of life experiences. Health, food, friends, sleep, safety, comfort, or none of that. He said, I've learned the secret of contentment. And secret, as in I've learned the secret, when we hear secret, we mean, hey, did you hear? This was a term they would have recognized. It was a technical term used by what were called mystery religions at the time. So all around Philippi, there was all these different kind of designer religions people made up. And these mystery religions, they were called mystery because you had to have the gee whiz secret, the secret handshake, secret word, secret action to get in, to get the spiritual secret sauce that you needed to live well. And so Paul hijacks this word for the gospel. He said, I've learned the mysterious secret. I can do everything that needs to be done in whatever circumstances it needs to be done in through Christ who strengthens me. So he's saying it's no secret. It's been revealed, Christ in me. I've learned to be content. I haven't learned that yet. When I read that, it's enormously challenging. I haven't learned that yet. I am better, but I haven't learned it yet. Last week, one of our youth, a high school freshman, asked me right over there in that hall, he said, when you're around chaplains of different faiths, do you ever doubt yours? That's a sort of a paraphrase. And I said, it's okay if you doubt your faith, and it's okay if you ask questions. In fact, it's great that you ask these questions. I'm so glad that you do. And that's a great one. But no, I don't. I don't doubt my faith anymore. I've learned to love friends of other faiths, but I don't doubt my faith. I've seen too much. I've experienced too much. The gospel's just true. But you keep asking questions. You keep being honest. You keep growing. And my point in that is to say this. If I could talk to Paul, if he showed up in Wichita in the 21st century, I would ask him, do you ever feel discontent? I mean, is this a statement of life direction, kind of a vision statement, because sometimes he would give these vision statements, or is this a declaration of fact of where you've reached in your heart? I know you said in the last chapter that you haven't been made perfect in regards to sin, but have you really gotten to this point of real contentment, or is this a statement of vision? I don't know what he'd answer, obviously, but based on how he's written this, I think he would probably say, Terry, it's okay that you're often discontent, it's where you are. But I'm not anymore. I've experienced too much. I've seen too much. I've suffered too much. I'm content in all things because of Christ in me. And then he would probably say to me, but Terry, you need to be sure to be discontent with your discontentment. You need to keep growing, keep learning what it means to stand firm in your faith. You need to be a person who is continually learning to be content in all things, because you can, if you just will. So let's finish up with another look at our stand firm strategy. 5 strategic inputs. Stand together, have the mind of Christ, rejoice your mind continually in the Lord. Be a person who's ruled by truth, not passions. Live resolutely in the reality of your peace with God, and let emotions come and go, and then choose what you allow to shape your thoughts. Now, what do these 5 things have in common? 1, well, we can choose them, but what else? Well, they're all functions of the mind, the thinking. My wife and I have had many great conversations over the years about what it means to be a thinker and a feeler. Pretty regularly. We had one a couple weeks ago. And I'm more likely to start with thinking. She's more likely to start with feeling. And we've learned that each starting point has its place depending on the context. And we've learned to appreciate each other because we both know that every thinker feels and every feeler thinks. The lines aren't always that distinct. But when the Bible talks about the place of the mind, and it does a lot, it's not using contemporary categories of personality like we do. Is he a thinker? Is he a feeler? The Bible assumes the fact that every human lives from their heart. And the heart in the Bible is not like it in Western civilization, where the heart is the feeling part of you. The heart in the Bible is the command post. It's the thinking, choosing, deciding, willing part of you. And that involves feeling as well. So the command post operates based on intel or information, ideas. Ideas shape passion, desire. If the information is wrong that our command post, our hearts are operating on, and Proverbs is full of this principle, Be careful what you let shape your heart, the command post of your life. If the information is wrong, then the command post will issue bad decisions and battles and wars are lost. So we're to make sure that we're careful what we allow to shape our thinking is in line with the reality of truth of God, the gospel. So once again, we've talked about this all year. Beliefs, what is true, shape values, what matters most to us, shapes behaviors, how we live our lives. And we have to decide what ideas, what thoughts, what data we're going to allow to remain in our minds and our hearts and our lives. By all means, be a passionate relational person. Be a feeler. My wife is, and most time I'm really grateful for that. I always should be grateful for that. I'm not there yet either. But for everyone to stand firm, we must carefully and consistently watch what we let shape our minds. So stand together, have the mind of Christ. Put this in your mind. It's not about me. There is no happy person who lives for themselves. Put that thought in your mind. Rejoice your mind in the Lord. I can and must keep rejoicing in the Lord. Be a reasonable person, meaning ruled by truth, not by passions. Pray and live resolutely in the reality of your peace with God. If I'm a Christian, the peace of God is the objective truth of my life. I have to believe that truth regardless of what I currently feel, or I'm going to be tossed around. I can't stand firm. If I obey my feelings, I can't stand firm. And then choose what you allow to shape your thoughts. I have to go after the kinds of heart, mind, life-shaping thoughts that are excellent and praiseworthy. And someone can say, well, Terry, you're just turning all this into a thinking, intellectual exercise. I want to feel. I want to have passion. I want to have deep relationship with God. What are those but statements of truth? Are those not statements of fact? If you say, Terry, I want to have deep, passionate relationship with God, is that not an idea of what you want? And if we don't carefully choose to let truth abide in our minds, shaping our thoughts, our hearts are going to become malformed. Real, life-giving passion will be absent. People who start thinking wrong thoughts about marriage and relationship and happiness, ideas about what real passion looks like, they chase passion detached from the reality that God's revealed, and they end up with nothing. They have no passion, no joy, no relationship. Truth is essential for everything good. So what do you want? Who do you want to be? See, I want to be increasingly content. I want to be spiritually resilient. I want truth-directed passion. I want to know Jesus and the power of the resurrection. I want to stand firm. Good. So do I. And we understand because God's mercy has showed us what it means to move that way. And what's fascinating to me is that in order to stand firm, you have to continually move. You have to continually move in your mind and your hearts and your choices towards the reality of the gospel. Let's pray together. Talk to God about your life, listen to Him, and respond to Him.